you ever get sad because you think the bad things should never happen to you? Well, the biblical view is that the Bible never promises that bad things shall not happen to Christians. But in fact, the Bible promises that bad things will, even as bad things happen to people in the world. Simultaneously, the Bible shows that we can be filled with joy because our joy is not based on the things going on around us, but they are based on the things that are going on inside us. I want to give you two passages from the Gospel according to John, chapter 14 and then chapter 16. And remember that as Jesus is speaking these words, that he is uttering them on the night in which he knows he is about to be betrayed. He knows that he's not going to sleep that night. He knows that he is going to endure six trials. He knows what's going to happen at those trials, and he knows that in 24 hours, he's already in the grave. Nevertheless, in John 14:27, Jesus said, "Peace I leave with you. My peace I give to you. Not, he says, not as the world gives do I give to you. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid." It seems like they should be telling him those things. But he is saying those things to them. And then look what he says over in the 16th chapter, verse 33. "These things I have spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation. But be of good cheer, I have overcome the world." With the implication that therefore you can overcome the world. Before he even goes through his ultimate suffering, he's saying, "I've already overcome the world. And I have peace." In fact, he has so overcome the world already before it even happens that he's able to speak peace to these men. And of course, they're going to experience horrendous suffering themselves. And they will experience his peace and joy. And as a result, we quote from them in the other parts of the New Testament. We're quoting from John here, who heard these words from Jesus initially. So Jesus had joy in the face of great suffering. I'd like to take you now to the book of Hebrews and look at chapter 12. Consider the first couple of verses, as well as some things that are said in the 11th chapter. First of all, I want you to notice in verse 1 how he shows us that we need to run our race with endurance. He says, "Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." Well, look the way he's beginning. "Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses." Well, who are these witnesses that he's talking about? Well, he's just presented to us, back in the 11th chapter, some people who endured some things, some pretty bad things. And he says, "Look, they're witnesses to us that we can do it." Look back at chapter 11, starting at verse 32. "And what more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword. Out of weaknesses were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead, raised to life again, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Still others had trial of mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains and imprisonments. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. Were tempted. Were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains, in dens and caves of the earth. Wow. The writer says, these are the ones who are witnessing to us. They saw that suffering firsthand. They experienced it. But they kept pressing on. They didn't give up. They didn't quit. They stayed with the Lord, and they stayed with whatever He wanted them to do. They were all triumphant over their troubles, and they are witnesses to us that we also can be victorious over whatever troubles are placed before us. Therefore, he argues, coming into chapter 12 now in verse 1, that we need to lay aside every weight that ensnares us. You know, can you run with weight? You know, the more weight you put on, the more difficult it is. And if you add on enough weights, and it really won't be a whole lot that will be needed, you'll just stop completely. You just won't be able to run. And sometimes we add spiritual weight so that running is difficult. And sometimes we add so much, and again, it may not be a whole lot that's needed, that it just stops us completely. And you know, when you're doing that, when you're running, if you have too much weight on, it's not fun to run. It's not enjoyable. Well, in the same way, Christianity and the trials of life, there's no joy in them when we keep adding on all these weights. We pile on things that weigh us down, keeping us from running the Christian race. And then we wonder why Christianity is such a struggle for us. Luke chapter 8 has a parable in which Jesus shows how we, his followers, sometimes make our own lives difficult. I mean, the world doesn't even have to do it. The devil doesn't even have to do it. Sometimes we just do it to ourselves. Here's what he says as Jesus interprets one of his parables. He says in verse 14, "Now the ones that fell among thorns are those who, when they have heard, go out and are choked with cares, riches, and pleasures of this life and bring no fruit to maturity." And see, these cares, riches, and pleasures of this life are things that we add. The devil's not doing it. The world's not doing it. Other people are not doing it. It's something that we do to ourselves. And these weights that we add make it difficult, if not impossible, to have joy in the face of suffering. In fact, sometimes if we get so weighted down with these things, we will even think that expression, joy and in the face of suffering, how could you be talking like that? Is there something wrong with you or something? And yet, it's a biblical concept because it can be done. Moreover, the Hebrew writer urges us, back there in 12:1, to lay aside the sin, he says, that so easily ensnares us. And I'll tell you, that can be even more difficult than the weight that's added. You get something tangled up in your legs, and it only takes one vine to do it. Because I've had that happen to me as I run through the woods. Man, it slows you down fast, and you'll stop. And the moment you're ensnared, He just can't run anymore. Running's not a joy, it's irritation. You get irritated at whatever got entangled around your legs. And this is what happens when we are ensnared in sin. We cannot run the Christian race anymore. So that Christianity and the trials of life are not a joy, they're an irritation. We can actually get irritated in our Christianity if we get ensnared in a sin. And it may only take one sin to do it. This is the point of James, excuse me, in James chapter 2, when he shows her the danger of becoming ensnared in only one sin. Because that's all it takes. Starting at verse 10, he says, "For whoever shall keep the whole law and yet stumble in one point, he's guilty of all. For he who said, 'Do not commit adultery,' also said, 'Do not murder.' Now, if you do not commit adultery, but you do murder, you have become a transgressor of the law. You're a lawbreaker." He's arguing. Although all you're doing is breaking one part of God's law. He's not talking here about, you know, as we struggle through life and we fall into sin. But here we are making a practice of something. Making a practice of a sin. I mean, we're right on with everything else. But there's one area, and it can bring us down, he says. How many sins brought down Judas? Just one. He was a covetous man. He didn't commit adultery. He did not murder. He didn't gossip. There's a lot of things Judas didn't do. In fact, there's a lot of good things he did. I mean, we have a tendency to look at Judas from this side of all the events. We look at him as the betrayer. But hey, the man went out. Did you realize that Judas went out and preached with the approval of Jesus, and he actually performed miracles? He had a lot of good, but he got ensnared. He got tangled up in one sin, and it brought the man down. Continuing in the book of Hebrews, there is one witness, the writer will show us now, who suffered more than the examples that he gave us in the 11th chapter. And this one example was joyful in the face of massive suffering. So now verse 2 says this, "Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God." We have all those examples there in chapter 11, and now he gives us the ultimate example, the example of Jesus Christ. All those people in chapter 11, the point that he was making there is they were all triumphant because of their faith. And so now he draws our attention to the one who is the author and finisher of our faith. Look at the people of faith in chapter 11. The whole chapter, some people call it God's Hall of Faith. Now, here's the one who authors faith. Here is the one who finishes our faith. By faith we can keep the added weights off and keep from becoming ensnared in sin. Therefore, we can win the Christian race. And you know, who's ever sad after winning a race? You know, whenever I've seen some kind of race in person, or if I see it on TV, I've never seen the victor yet. Well, in fact, just today I saw the news. I saw who the winner was of the Daytona 500. And I didn't hear what he had to say, but I could tell he was speaking to the crowd with a microphone. And I... just by the look on his face, I don't think he was saying, "You know something, I wish I had come in last place." No, he was glad. You know, he was doing those donuts, you know, how they do. He was very excited. "Therefore, let us look to Jesus, although many things surrounding us try to distract us. But if we keep our eyes fixed on Jesus, we can win and be joyful," is what he says. Let me give you two examples of those who looked to Jesus. At least one who did temporarily. The first example I want to give you is Acts chapter 7. Now in Acts chapter 7 we're introduced to the man, our brother Stephen. Stephen first, in this context, sees Jesus with the spiritual eye. And then he is blessed to be able to see Jesus with his literal eye. But just after he's delivered a sermon, starting in verse 55, it then says, "But he, being full of the Holy Spirit, gazed into heaven and saw the glory of God, and Jesus standing at the right hand of God, and said, Look, I see the heavens opened, and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God." Then they cried out with a loud voice, that is, the people who he was speaking to, stopped their ears and ran at him with one accord. And they cast him out of the city and stoned him. But there's more. And the witnesses laid down their clothes at the feet of a young man named Saul. And they stoned Stephen as he was calling on the Lord, or on God, and saying, "Lord Jesus, receive my spirit." Then he knelt down and cried out with a loud voice, "Lord, do not charge them with this sin." And when he had said this, he fell asleep. Well, I suppose we could say that literally Stephen saw Jesus with his eyes first, because he was alive during that generation. But what moves him to speak the way he does in Acts chapter 7 is that he saw Christ with the spiritual eye. And then just before he dies, the Lord allows him to see the one he's about to meet. But I think what is so amazing about this is that Stephen kept his eyes on Christ right in the middle of his stoning. Have you ever wondered how you stoned someone? Now, I've heard of the different ways that it was done. I've heard sometimes they would hold a person down and just literally drop or throw the rocks down on them. And other ways, they just would throw them at the person as they cornered them. But either way, he's not looking at the ones throwing the stones at him. He's not looking at the rocks coming at him. He's looking at Jesus. He's totally focused on our Master. Nothing is going to distract him. He will not let anything distract him. No problems and no problem people. He keeps his eyes on Jesus Christ. Next is Matthew chapter 14. There's another example of a man who kept his eyes on Jesus, but when that man started to look at the situation he was in, and it was a dangerous situation, he ran into trouble. Matthew chapter 14, starting at verse 28. And here what happens is, you probably know, Jesus has walked on the water. The apostles see him. They think it's a ghost. He tells them, "Be of good cheer, it's I." And Peter challenges him, "Lord, if it's you, command me to come out on the water." Jesus says, "Come." So verse 28. And Peter answered him and said, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." So he said, "Come." And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water. Jesus is not the only one who's walked on water. There's actually been two people in the history of the world who've walked on water. And Peter was one of them. He issued a challenge to the Lord. The Lord took up the challenge. And Peter went. "If it's you, Lord, I'm going to come right out to you." And he has the power to do it. Verse 30. But, you know, you knew that part was coming. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid. And notice he doesn't drop like a rock. It says, and beginning to sink, he cried out saying, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" I don't know how far Jesus was from the boat when this started, but it sounds like maybe Peter went some distance. And he's so amazed by what he's doing, and he's looking at Jesus, but then he suddenly remembers why they're in trouble. And he suddenly remembers what's going on. and the wind and the waves. And he takes his eyes off Jesus Christ, and what happens? He doesn't fall again like a rock, but he begins to sink. It almost sounds like it's somewhat of a slow process. He's able to say, "Lord, save me." And you don't say, you can't even say those amount of words if you just drop like a rock. So Peter at first zeroed in on Christ, but something else caught his attention, and he allowed himself to be distracted. We really do need to see every situation and every problem as having the potential to make us more fit for the kingdom of heaven, or as being a distraction that we might lose faith and hence lose the prize of heaven. There are two who are watching us, or at least two, God and Satan. And God looks at you as you struggle through life and as you have all these distractions. God's looking at you and he says, "You know what? These can make you better. We can work on this together and you can be a better disciple of Jesus Christ, of my son." But the devil's looking and he's thinking, "You can't do it. I'm going to throw up one distraction after another. I don't want you to look at God. I want you to look at me. I want you to be distracted. And you'll sink just like I've sunk. I want you down here with me." Now let's go back to Hebrews chapter 11, because it gives yet another example of someone who became great. Because he did what Stephen did, and at least what Peter had started to do. Hebrews 11 tells us about Moses, starting at verse 24, and how he avoided distraction by focusing on Christ. Hebrews 11, 24. "By faith Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible." See what Moses did? Yes, there was some sorrow in his life. There was some aggravation in his life. But he kept his eyes focused on the prize, and he was able to have joy also in the face of great suffering and distraction. And it's the same thing in our lives. Regardless of what surrounds us, and regardless of how awful the problems are, we should keep thinking on Christ and not focus on the other things and people or whatever it is or troubles that we have. Stay focused on Christ. Keep looking to Jesus, because he is the author and finisher of our faith. Since he is the author of our faith, he can show us how to have a good start to the Christian race. Since he is the finisher of our faith, he can show us how to finish in the best shape and in the best time. How did Jesus, though, manage to endure the cross? How did he outlast the physical, the emotional, and the spiritual agonies of the cross? How did he do that? He did not use miraculous power. What enabled him to endure great suffering are the same things that enable us to endure whatever suffering stands before us. Yes, we can get frustrated at times, but if we look to Jesus, we can find that he not only endured his suffering, but Hebrews chapter 12 argues that he even had joy in the face of massive suffering. Look again carefully at what the writer said there in verse 2. He spoke about Jesus, who for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross. That's how he endured the cross. He had a joy set before him. Not meaning that the cross was joyful, because it wasn't. But there was some kind of joy out there. There was some kind of joy before him or above him or both. And that's how he was able to endure. Continue to remember the racing illustration that the writer is using. In a foot race, especially in a long distance race, there are all kinds of aches, pains, obstacles, you know, competitors and other things tempting the runner to quit. But he doesn't. Why? What keeps him going? He stays focused on something. He remembers the prize. He remembers the glory of winning. And so he keeps on going in spite of the problems. Several years ago, Carrie helped the Red Cross in Klamath Falls because there was a girl over there, and it was made well known in town, who had leukemia. And they were looking for donors, you know, who could give bone marrow. And so this was going to be a 3-day event. And they were expecting 300 people in 3 days. On the first day alone, 420 people showed up. And Carrie dealt with 50 of those people. She interviewed them and so on. And the thing that she couldn't believe is how many people were scared to death to have a needle poked in their arm and have blood drawn out. They were very nervous. But they did it anyways, because they had the joy of helping a little girl. That's what they were thinking of. I don't like what's going to happen. I don't like having needles stuck in me. I don't like seeing the tube filled with blood. But there's a little girl who, you know, maybe my bone marrow will help her. And if I don't give it, she'll die. So they had a joy set before them. And they went ahead with it. That's exactly what's going on here in Hebrews 12 with Jesus. And it's the same thing that the Hebrew writer is telling us to do. Have a joy set before you. And then you can endure, then you will endure whatever is placed before you. So, did Jesus attain the joy? Did he make it? Did he have the joy fulfilled that was set before him? Well, again, look at verse 2 of Hebrews 2. And see how it ends. Again, I want to read the whole verse to you. It says that we should be looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. That means he made it. He has made possible by his blood the redemption of the whole human race. And as a reward for doing that, the Father says, Son, you're going to sit right here with me on my throne, on my right-hand side. He suffered beyond measure, but in the end, he sat down. I mean, he's got the greatest prize there is, sitting next to God. Now, I want to give you one last scripture for tonight. Listen to Revelation chapter 3. And be thrilled. Be thrilled, brethren, at the prospect of what is revealed here. But again, what I'm about to read here is only for those who run with endurance the race that is set before us. Okay? Here's what Jesus says to us in Revelation 3:21. Listen carefully. Jesus says, to him who overcomes, I will grant to sit with me on my throne, as I also overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne. How would you like to sit next to Jesus Christ? You know, Carrie and I are, you know, we've been working here for almost 2.5 years, and we still haven't gotten a scriptural pew yet. We're always moving around. And one reason is because we like to sit next to different people. We like sitting next to people. I think you do too. We like to be with people, especially with someone that is special to us. Well, how about Jesus? If you saw Jesus and he was sitting down and there's a seat empty next to him, and it's a time to sit down, would you go sit next to him? I'm sure you would. But he says here, up here in heaven, he can sit right down here with me. Wow, I want to do that. And I want you to also. Therefore, get in the race and endure to the end and don't give up. Now, if there's a weight that's pulling you down, if there's a snare that's got your feet all tangled up, we want to help you to get that weight off and get untangled so you can run with us. Just like, you know, I've heard about the Special Olympics where a runner falls. And the rest of the runners stop. And they help him get up and they all run together. Well, that's what we are. We're in the Special Olympics. And we want to help you run. If you need our help, come forward right now as we stand and sing.